Chaitanya, Rabu Nichananda Shidwaita Ganatha, Shivasa Soul, Vastavan Nikachai, Jishi, Radhakrishna, Gopakabara Sayam Kunda, Radhakunda, Giriovaran Kijai, Vrindavaram Kijai, Maturidam Kijai, Navadip Dam Kijai, Jagadavasami Kijai, Yumanamai Kijai, Shimadi Lasidevi Kijai, Samaveda Bhakta Vrindigijai, Gaur Privananda Hari Hari Bo. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories, the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga. So the title of this class or seminar, whatever you call it, is going to be the history of Indian religions. And I'm going to explain why I'm giving this class and how I got the information from this class and what inspires me to give this class before I begin. Actually, I was listening to some of the classes that Rita Nandamaraj gave on the history of Indian religion at the University of Florida. And after hearing his academic presentation and his understanding of Krishna consciousness and his presentation that the actual Vedic conclusion and the original Vedic conclusion was worship of Krishna, I became inspired to present this to the devotees in general rather than just in an academic setting. Because devotees, first of all, are going to be confronting people in the university. So it's important they understand a little bit about the history of India and also about the history of the Vedic literatures. And secondly, for the devotee's own faith in Krishna consciousness, because having faith in the spiritual master and faith in the Vedas is extremely important, as we know from Yasya Devi Para Bhakti Yita Devi Tata Guru Tashyaite Katita Yarta Prakashante Mahatmana, that if one has faith in the Vedic literatures and in the spiritual master, then everything's revealed to one. And Krishna also says, tell me if I go too fast, because I have a tendency to go real fast. Krishna also says, Ashradana Purusha Dharma Shasha Parantapa Prapyamam Nivartante Mrityu Samsara Vartmani. Those who don't have faith, they return to birth and death in this material world and they can't attain Krishna. So faith is a very important thing for the devotees. So I was very much inspired to present this to the devotees for that purpose, for those two purposes, for preaching and for their own internal purposes. Therefore, I decided to do something a little unusual for me, which is present something academic at the camp, whereas usually I'm doing all the New Age stuff. Not exactly New Age, the, you know, communications and stuff like that. So this is going to be more or less an academic presentation, and I want you all to interrupt me by raising your hand, not by screaming at me. If you have any questions, because there's going to be some terminology that you may not be familiar with that I may be using because I'm familiar with it, okay? Really, really important. Anyway, so, see, there was some other introductory things. Oh, yeah, there's one other purpose. One of the purposes for this presentation is that as we see the interactions of different religions and the presentations of different religions and the development historically of different religions in India, including the Vedic interpretations of the Vedic religion, we can apply that to our understanding of some of the dynamics that are occurring in the Krishna consciousness movement. Because the sociology of religion applies to every single religious organization. You know, sometimes we in ISKCON think that we're sort of transcendental to sociology. In other words, the different types of interactions we have in a society. But we're actually a textbook case, you understand what that means, of, you know, of a development of a religious institution. And if we hear how other religious institutions and other religions develop throughout the ages, specifically in India, and we're going to be making reference also to Western religions and the development of some brief mention of Western religions and the development of Western religions, then you can actually understand more about social dynamics within ISKCON. So it's going to be interesting from that aspect. I mean, I'm very interested in this stuff. So I hope some of you are. It's not going to be one of those, you know, rasa dance type of classes. I'm sorry about that, you know. I heard some people say, you know, he's not giving a rasa dance today, but that's life. Anyway, so let's get on with the course. That's the introduction. So, of course, India is a very unique place. It's probably the best place to study about religion. Of course, India is the land of religion. It's understood to be like that. So there's several reasons, both academically, you know, and practically, why India is the land of religion. One reason is that Krishna appeared there, and the incarnations appear there. There was a pretty good reason. And civilization appeared there, in spite of modern anthropologists and archaeologists stating that civilization appeared in different places like Mesopotamia and Egypt, you know, in places like that. It actually appeared in India. And anyway, so, and there's many reasons. So India is the best place to study religion also because throughout the ages, up until the time of the invasion of the Muslims, there has been complete freedom of religion. In fact, not only freedom of religion, there's been freedom of the press, freedom of speech. By press, I don't mean only newspapers. There's been freedom of speech, amazing freedom of speech, which has just been present in the Western world, let's say, for the last 200 years, maybe, in some places in the Western world. And it's not even present everywhere in the whole world at this point. For example, I'll give you an example. 2,500 years ago, roughly 2,500 years ago, actually a little less than that, I'm sorry, about 2,200 years ago, when you had the first Greek ambassadors, and we'll give some quotes about this, going to India, they spoke about the relative freedom that people had there, the hospitality the people had there, and I'm going to read from the quotes from this particular individual called Megasthenes about this in a few minutes. So anyway, so there was complete freedom of speech. You could go to the marketplace and denounce the king if you wanted to. I mean, in most places in the world, you can't do that today. I mean, you can't go to Iran, for example, and denounce, you know, the supreme leader, Khomeini, right? I mean, they'll come out, all of his thugs will come out and beat you to death, practically speaking. Probably you've all been reading the news lately about this? Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about. But like you find at the time, just referring back to Lord Ramchandra's time, you had these people who are criticizing Lord Ramchandra for accepting Sita Devi back. You know, this one man said, I'm not going to accept my wife back because she, you know, who knows where she went for the night. And so I'm not like that Lord Ram who accepted Sita Devi. And so Lord Ram took that seriously, didn't he? And he asked Sita Devi to leave. Whereas in the modern day kings, as I hear, you know, someone criticizing their wives, it's off of their head, so to speak. You don't want to do that. So India has this amazing history of freedom of speech and freedom of religion. Mm-hmm. In general, there were no wars up until the time, I mean, there are exceptions, little exceptions, up until the time of the Muslim invasion, there were no wars fought over religion. And that's amazing, too. I mean, if you look at the history of the Abrahamic religions, does everyone understand that term? Abrahamic means the three religions that came from the Middle East: Jewish religion, Christian religion, the Islamic tradition. They are full of violence. If you read the Old Testament, which I've been doing recently, not because I'm feeling a lack in my own Krishna consciousness, but because this is, you know, part of my preaching, that I have to interact with people from different religions. You hear about the Jewish people being advised by God to go to practically every town and village they go through that's inhabited by, you know, non-Jewish people, and kill every man, woman, child, and animal there. I mean, amazing, amazing cruelty, barbarism. And then, you know, we all know the history of the Crusades in Europe, right? I mean, actually, well, even in this area, especially in this area of the world, you know. Yeah, the Turkish invasion, they were driven. What? The Inquisition. And then I think we know the history of Muslim jihads, too. And I'm not going to get into that. But India never had that until the Muslims invaded. In fact, you'll hear later on how when you had the original Vedic culture and then there was the Buddhists who came and the Jains came, they peacefully existed. Emperor Ashoka, who became a Buddhist, and we'll talk about him later, he allowed all the different religions in his particular purview, you know, under what he was under, what he was controlling. And he was controlling a vast amount of India. He had even conquered Kalinga, which is a modern-day Orissa. So that's the background. India also has a very large population. And because of this freedom, just the people in general, amazing amount of very intelligent people in India. A lot of modern science, modern mathematics, you know, you even have zero being thought of first in India. I mean, it may not seem like a lot. It's not a lot, zero. But, you know, the concept of zero was, they first thought of in India, modern mathematics. Pythagoras, you've heard of Pythagoras? You know, A squared plus B squared equals C squared, Pythagorean theory. Pythagoras got his ideas from India. In fact, he had like Pythagorean cults where people were vegetarian and they practiced, you know, some aspect of yoga and they believed in reincarnation because they were on the trade route, you know, in Greece between India and in the West. So you'll find a lot of sophistication, even architecture, you know, sometimes in the Middle East, the Muslims are acclaimed, certain types of Muslims who have architecture, are acclaimed for having wonderful architecture. That architecture actually came from India originally. The concepts of architecture came from India. And design. Anyway, and then as far as language is concerned, Sanskrit, you know, is perhaps the most precise scientific language known to mankind. In fact, the modern study of language came from the study of Sanskrit by the Western Europeans. You know, when the first Western Europeans studied Sanskrit, they were amazed at this. And we're going to read some quotes about that in a second. Anyway, there's every conceivable kind of religion in India. I mean, and religions that you couldn't even conceive of. You know, there was Hinduism of different types, there was worship, Vaishnavism, Shaivism, Buddhism, Jains, Sikhs, Shaktas, you know, all sorts of interesting things, you know, left-handed people, right-handed people, witches. I mean, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty, because of that freedom and intelligence to develop things. In fact, India, the culture is such that every part of the individual's life was considered religious. You understand? Like even going to eat was part of the religion. Eating was part of the religion. Going to swim in the river is part of the religion. It's amazing. Religion is. Of course, nowadays, that's the final topic I'm going to talk about, you know, final day if we get time. By the modern culture, you know, religion has become modern influence. Western culture, religion is being taken out of the minds and the hearts of the Indian people. But originally, every part of their life was religious. Just like we have here in our Krishna consciousness movement, you know, we get up in the morning, offer our obeisances, take a bath because we're going to go see the deities. Everything is integrated into Krishna consciousness. So that's the same way that life in India was up until the modern time. So people actually lived in a God-centered environment. In addition, Anyway, India was also invaded by the three Abrahamic religions, but they didn't have the best intentions. They wanted to convert people. So India also today has 1/5 of all the people in the world, the 4th largest economy in the world, largest democracy in the world, and independently they came up with a very sophisticated religious philosophy, okay, which actually nowhere or no other religion in the world has actually come up with an independent philosophy. Like you'll see in the Christian religion, they borrowed their philosophy from the Greeks. And of course, in the Islamic tradition, also they borrowed from the Greeks and from the Christians and from the Jews. So India independently is great. Also, just a few facts about India. India has the best river system in the world, a diverse topography. You know what topography is? It means geography. Or the highest mountains in the world. And there's a reason I'm going to tell about this. The best beaches in the world. And the reason I'm mentioning that is that with its diverse topography, you find actually different types of people developing different types of religious understanding in addition to the Vedic culture, or different interpretations of the original Vedic culture. Okay, and in order to study religion in any country, religion in India or any country, we're going to take a particular approach. We're going to take the approach of the market-based approach, the economic approach. And that doesn't mean we're going to study money in religion, which is interesting for me, but that's not what we're going to study. We're going to study when religion is presented to the people, how sometimes there's an adjustment in the presentation of the religion, understanding of the religion, to get more followers or to compete against other religions. Does everyone understand that concept? Very interesting. So that's the paradigm we're studying in. Because religion influences history, and the presentation of religion is influenced by history. Am I clear to everybody? Anyone have any questions at this point about anything? No. So this, you know, religious market, just like nowadays we're studying how to present Krishna consciousness in the Western world. So therefore, we have to study the marketplace. We have to study our competition, what they're doing. So many devotees are presenting Krishna consciousness in terms of yoga, Ayurveda, like Prahladananda Maharaj is giving a seminar in yoga, Ayurveda. Many devotees are, let's say, presenting Krishna consciousness in terms of using cooking classes and other means like that. Because we have to market Krishna consciousness. We can't just go out in the street and say, surrender. Krishna says, sarva dharma puricha ja, mame kam sharanam braja, or you go to hell. It's just not going to work with people. We have to understand who they are, what their needs are, and present Krishna consciousness in terms of their needs. Of course, interestingly enough, this is a side note and it's part of the course, that one of the basic human needs is to worship a personal God. Now, the atheistic anthropologists, they say that we are thinking or wanting to worship a personal God because we are persons ourselves, or we are humans ourselves, so we're projecting our concept upon God. There was one pre-Socratic philosopher, I think his name was Xenophanes, who said, if horses had God, he would look like a horse. If Africans had God, he would look black. So there's this, it's called the anthropomorphic argument against the existence of God. Does everybody follow that? So, but the point we're making is that we are made, as the Bible says, in God's image. And our basic let's say, desire to worship a person, God, is actually part of the soul's nature. The atheists, the scholars, they say, or the, well, let's get back to the Marxists, atheists, that's a nice word to use, scholars, evolutionary scholars say that our desire to worship a personal God will be overcome as we evolve further. They made that point actually 80 years ago. About 70, 80 years ago. So they're still making the point. But we see that our desire to worship a personal God has not diminished in the least. In fact, it's actually increased. And not only that, you'll find out that whenever a religion is presented without a concept of a personal God, that religion eventually develops a concept of a personal God. Let's take Buddhism, for example. In the beginning, there was absolutely no concept, the way Buddha presented things and his later followers, and we'll speak about that in depth. There was absolutely no concept of a personal God. Incidentally, Buddha never denied the existence of God, although his followers do, many of his followers do. But what happened in Buddhism is eventually they started to develop concepts of heaven, personal God, or gods, worship, ceremonies, that was never part of Buddhism in the beginning. And so therefore, the most popular Buddhism is Mahayana Buddhism, rather than Theravada Buddhism. Don't worry about the terms. We're going to talk about Buddhism in a few days. But the most Mahayana means that they actually have all these different ceremonies, the pujas, the persons, the going to heaven, the bodhisattvas. Bodhisattva means like a Shaktivesha avatar, basically, in our conception. So it's amazing. They start out atheistic and they become theistic. Amazing. So that proves that it is part of our nature to worship a personal God, because we're persons. And we're part and parcel of God, as we know from Gita. Okay. So in our study of Indian theology or religion, we're going to understand different points of view, too. It's called POV. In the beginning, religion was always studied in seminaries. That means ashrams, for those of you from India. Okay? And later on, and therefore the slant was true believer. Everyone who studied was a true believer. I'm just explaining academically the way things are understood. And then later on, religion began to be studied in the universities. And the universities, they were true unbelievers. The actual opposite. So when they studied religion, that's actually a warning for you, those of you who may want to study religion in the university. They take the particular concept of what's called methodological atheism. And I'm going to explain that. So, because you're going to run into scholars and people all over the place when you start to preach Krishna consciousness, or you have been preaching Krishna consciousness, who will deny the existence of God and will see development of a religion simply as a sociological or psychological phenomena. Now, just raise your hand if you want me to stop It's a little academic, this stuff, but it, you know, for me it's interesting. I don't know if for all of you it's interesting. So I have to have some feedback. It's not like my regular classes where I'm dancing all around and everything. So, but you know, intellectually I'm very stimulated by this. So I want to make sure it's meeting all of your needs. So in general in the university, at least almost 100% in the past, they studied through the lens of methodological atheism. In other words, let's say they study the Krishna consciousness movement. They would say, you all join the movement, because, and you accepted a spiritual master because you were looking for a father figure. Or, you know, you weren't satisfied in your love life at home or something like that. You know, just, they would give some sociological, or you need a group to belong to. You know, some people belong to the Crips, you know, these are gangs, what? And the Bloods. But you belong to the Hare Krishnas. You need some sociological identification. So in the university, there's actually a slant or a bias against belief in God. In other words, if you're a teacher teaching in the university, you can't say to your class, unless it's a Krishna conscious university, you know, Krishna is God and he dances in the spiritual world. But you can say Krishna is not God. Can you imagine that? But that's also a theological statement. Whether you say Krishna is God or Krishna is not God is a religious statement. Because how do you know? Like Prabhupada would talk about the inductive reasoning that people have. Induction means you see certain things in this world and you draw a general conclusion. And that's a faulty method of understanding things. Anytime you say make an absolute negative statement, that absolute negative statement contradicts itself. Like if you say there is no God, the only person who could say that would be God. You understand? Because how do you know? If you say there's no God, all you can say is, I have not seen God. Nobody in this, you know, at least you have not, yeah, I can't even say you have not seen God. So I could say I have never spoken to anyone who has told me he has seen God. Of course, I have probably seen God. So anytime you make a negative statement, like, I mean, of course, the impersonalists are very, let's say, expert in making negative statements like that. Anyway, it's self-contradictory statements, and we're going to talk about that philosophically. Everything is relative. But then that statement itself is an absolute statement. So any time there's a negation of something like that or an absolute statement, you should be very careful about that statement because usually that statement is self-contradictory. Just a little hint for you. Okay. So we talked about that's called blind doubt in the university or methodological atheism. So you got to be real careful because we find sometimes devotees go to the university and then they just take on this relative attitude towards Krishna consciousness, towards religion, and they give up Krishna consciousness. And I've seen that happen many, many times with some of my godbrothers. All right. But nowadays, there's what we call a postmodern approach. Some of the academic studies are actually taking a more balanced approach. You know, maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't a God. Maybe people are actually experiencing ecstasy if they're chanting Hare Krishna. We know we are, but at least in the academic world, why they take in a more balanced approach is very interesting, because there's more ladies in academia right now. That's a good one for you ladies. Because when it's just all the men just want to deny everything, you know, be the big bosses and everything. But when the ladies come into academia, there's more balanced feeling approach, okay? So that's a good thing. Okay. And also we're going to be, we're going to be studying Vedic culture in different periods, and also we're going to be talking about Indian religion going through what we call dialectics. A dialectic means, that means you have thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. What I mean exactly in that regarded is sometimes you have one religion, then a competing religion, and then the one religion or the competing religion adapt and it becomes one. Or the one religion adapts to the competing religion so it can compete against the one religion. I'll explain that further as we give examples. And we're going to be talking about that in three different periods. One is the end of the Vedic period, where you have the ancient Vedic religion that comes and this is 2,500 years ago. Actually, it's good if devotees have pen and paper so they can take notes, or at least have photographic memories, one of the two. So 2,500 years ago, it was sort of like the end of the original Vedic period, where the ancient Vedic religion was confronted with a competition from a group of people called Shramanas. Shramana, that's right. And Shramana, anyway, so they were dissatisfied with the presentation of the ancient Vedic religion, not the actual ancient Vedic religion. And as a result of that, that confrontation, of course, the Shramanas were people like people who are in the forest, you know, going to the woods, they're called Ranyakas, or the Buddhists, or the Jains. Okay? And interesting about the word Vedic, just so you know where it comes from, because we use that word a lot. Veda comes from the root vid, which means to know. And it's like the English word wit, you know? If you say someone is witty, that means very intelligent, good with words. And there's a German word, and those of you who speak German, forgive me if I don't pronounce it, probably Wissen or something like that. Anyone Germans here? Wissen. Wissen. Okay, the German word Wissen, to know. And also, one thing that's the favorite of all of you, video. You know what video is? Television, you know, video. So this you see the Sanskrit word, from the Sanskrit you get all these nice English words and words in other languages. The Sanskrit is actually the original tongue. And even the Sanskrit word jnana becomes in Greek the word gnosis, gnosis, G-N-O-I-S-I-S. It's nice, isn't it? Or in English, to know. Jnana, know. Because know, the word know in English is spelled K-N-O-W. And originally they would pronounce it kno. Like ganache, jnana, jnana, you know. Anyway. So it's very, very first. Anyway, something about Sanskrit. So then, that's the first period we'll study in terms of the dialectic. The second period is the period of Hinduism versus the Islamic tradition. And the third period, if we have time for it, is going to be the religions in India versus modernity, which is actually, you know, the Europeans first coming to India and then coming through the media as they're coming now to India, you know, the internet, television and everything like that, how that's influencing religion. Okay. Let's see what else. And of course, we're also going to be quoting, hopefully, extensively from the Bhagavad Gita, because the Bhagavad Gita is a lens through which we can understand. We can understand the different manifestations of religion. Because as Arjuna asked the question in Bhagavad Gita, if religion is not based on Shastra, is it in goodness, is it in passion, or is it in ignorance? And what does Krishna answer? Any Gita scholars here? The Visions of Faith chapter. Okay. Krishna answers, if religion is not in accordance with Shastra, the person who, whatever mode someone happens to be in, he develops that religion. In other words, if I'm not following Shastra, if I'm in the mode of ignorance, I'm going to develop a mode of ignorance religion or be attracted to a mode of ignorance religion. Worship the ghosts and the spirits, right? Just like voodoo. Anyone's heard of voodoo? I have one disciple who's a voodoo queen, anyway. Don't ask me how it happened. She has an internet page. She's a voodoo queen in New Orleans. And she says, I owe everything to my spiritual master, Bir Krishna Goswami. So. So, anyway.
Whatever.
You run into the most unusual things in Krishna consciousness. So if one is... Anyway, so if one is in the mode of ignorance, you tend towards those religions. You know, worshipping ghosts and spirits. Or if you're in the mode of passion, you worship what? Gita. Yeah, demigod. Or sometimes the demons. Demons. And so, another place is mentioned, demigods, to get the results. But... And those in the mode of goodness worship the demigods. So the most transcendental mode of goodness worship Krishna. So in other words, people develop religions according to their modes. And even though the Shastras or their scriptures may state something different, they will interpret their scriptures according to their modes. Which is really interesting. Anyway. Okay. Let's continue. Let's talk about the Vedic period. So Sanskrit itself is considered an Indo-European language. And we have the original four Vedas. Everybody knows the original four Vedas? Vedas. Rig. Sama and Atharva. Okay. So generally it's explained that the Sama Veda was dealing with the music and the rhythm of the Vedic hymns, the Rig Veda, the Vedic hymns, Yajurveda, the sacrifices. And from my research, the Atharva Veda was dealing with mantras or different types of weapons that people could get if they're fighting. So if you're interested in fighting, study the Atharva Veda. You want to study, learn about Brahmastras. So the Brahmanas, they would study, and they were Brahmanas expert in each one of the four Vedas. They would study the Vedas. And originally, the study of the Vedas was pretty much just for the Brahmanas, the higher castes. And in fact, in the Rig Veda, there's an interesting verse I want to read from Rig Veda 10:90, number 11 to 12, which you can all learn to quote. When they divided the Purusha, into how many parts did they apportion him? What do they call his mouth, his two arms, and things and feet? His mouth became the Brahmanas, his arms were made into the warrior, his thighs the people, and from his feet the servants or Shudras were born. So you have some understanding of the original, let's say, Varnashram system, or the Varna system. And of course, in the Bhagavad Gita, we have Chatravarna Maya Srishta Guna Karma Vibhagasha, where Krishna states that according to one's qualities and work, one is understood to be of a particular Varna. So the original Vedic understanding was that people could be assigned, even though they were born in a certain family, according to their nature, they could be assigned to be a different varna. Now, later on, that became transformed into the caste system. But even the original Vedic literatures, There's this interesting story of this one person named Satchikama, and it's a very famous story. And I'm sure some of you have heard about it before. Satchikama was born into, let's say, a family in which he didn't even know who his father was. His mother was like a prostitute or something like that. Anyway, not so chaste. So he wanted to become a Brahmin. He wanted to take initiation. He wanted to join the Hare Krishna movement or something like that. And so he approached his guru and he said, Gurudev, I would like to become your disciple. I would like to become a Brahmin. So Gurudev said to him, what's your gotra? You know, family line, like that. And because they ascertained there were different gotras. In India, it's very common to ask what someone's gotra is. Even when I go to the temples in India, sometimes they ask me what my gotra is. And I respond, as Srila Prabhupada instructed me to say, Achyuta gotra. That means, you know, we're descendants of Achyuta, Krishna. Actually, one time, anyway, I told the story before, but we can tell it again. We tried to get into one temple in Jagannath Puri, right next to Jagannath Puri, Sakshi Gopal Temple. And they were asking, what's your gotra? And someone said, one of my friends said, I'm a Brahmin from Gujarat, I'm a Brahmin from, another person was a Brahmin from South India. And I said, I'm a Brahmin from New York. And they said, get out of here. I said, what? I said, my father is Srila Prabhupada. And he said, oh, we don't believe it. Your skin's not the right color. Anyway. So anyway, Satchikama, he was asked, you know, what's your gotra? And he said, I don't know. He said, I got to ask my mother. Who's your father? You got to ask my mother. So he went to his mother. And he said, Mom, who's my dad? And his mother thought for a few minutes, and she said, I don't know. Could have been him. So, you know, she ran out of hymns. And he said, all right. And then he went back to his spiritual master, and he said to his spiritual master, when his spiritual master asked who your father was, he said, my mother doesn't know. She had, you know, a relationship with so many men. And the spiritual master said, you're a Brahmin. You know, why was he a Brahmin? Does anyone know? He was telling the truth. So there's that story in the Vedas. You know, so that sort of like throws out this whole caste system. So as far as this hierarchical caste system or Varnashram system, it's not something that was only in India. I mean, in Europe you had a caste system. Isn't it? I mean, people were born into a family of nobles, right? Don't you have that? Maybe not in this country. Plebeians, yeah. The plebeians. You know, in Europe you had a caste system. You had like a Varnashram system. If someone was a cobbler, you know what a cobbler is? Cobbler? Means, you know, make shoes for horses or shoeman. Yeah, shoes for people. Or if someone was a blacksmith, make shoes for horses, then that's how their children would be, right? You know, if someone was a nobleman in Great Britain, then his son would be a nobleman or something like that, unless he was completely incompetent. Of course, that's not a natural thing. Like Prabhupada said, that if you're a doctor, it's not that your son is a doctor automatically. You know, you're not going to let some 12-year-old boy operate on you just because his father happens to be a famous surgeon. So before the Industrial Revolution, there was a caste system, and actually, you even had like the so-called Brahmanas, because the first estate in Europe were the clergy. You know, the religious people, whether it was Catholic or Orthodox, you know, they were actually considered at the top of the hierarchy. Then you had the kings under them. So it's almost like a Varnashram system. So it's a natural system. I'm not saying that they adopted it from India, but Varnashram is natural whether or not you recognize it. Society divides it up, yourself up like that. Now, in the modern day, it's very interesting. We don't even have that Varnashram, that a person's position in society is dependent on how much money they have. And as Kali Yuga progresses, a person's position in society will be dependent upon how much Shudra talents they can manifest. Just like recently, you had the funeral of who? It was the most watched funeral in history, I think more than Kennedy. Right? I mean, perhaps billions of people watched, you know, and came, flew in there and watched this funeral. Why? Did he teach something, you know, amazing, world transforming? What? Moonwalk? I don't even know what it is. Remember, I've been in the Hare Krishna movement longer than you can, for two of your births. You know, I don't even know these things. You know, so what did he do for the world? You know, did he do brahminical things? Give us, like, spiritual knowledge? Did he give us a system of organization, kshatriya things? Did he write business books? Protect cows? What do you do? He entertained. And in the Vedic system, those who were entertainers were of a particular caste, which we can't mention right now. Yeah, I don't want to offend anybody, you know. You know, I got to be careful. So, because I may be offending someone's great, you know, most important artists that they've loved their whole life, of t-shirts, you know. You may have t-shirts of Michael Jackson on it. No. So I mean, it's crazy. Modern society is how shudra you are and how much money you are that determines how high you are in the social hierarchy. Huh? And they criticize the caste system? At least the caste system was based upon, the Varnashram system was based upon, you know, intelligence and practical dealings. Guna karma vibhagasha. But we, you know, we base it on money vibhagasha. Ridiculous, isn't it? So that it's natural. I mean, it's natural to have a hierarchical society. That's all I'm saying. Whether the hierarchy is based upon money or whether it's based on just like an imposed caste system or it's based upon the natural Varnashram system which Krishna has given us. Okay. All right, so there, as I mentioned before, there was social mobility and okay, got that. Just Rig Veda. Okay. I told the story of Osachakama. I told the story of Megasthenes. And, oh yeah. So Megasthenes, let me just make sure I got that quote here. Yeah. Oh yeah. Here, this is really nice. To give you an idea of Indian culture. So, actually the person's, it was called the Satchakama story, but the guy's name was Jaibali. Sorry. Jaibali. Satchakama means desire for the truth. So, anyway, so let's talk about the freedom of religion in the ancient Indian society for a second. I want to quote a little bit. So Megasthenes, who was a great ambassador, praised the Vedic system under the Emperor Ashoka. And these were his words. He's a famous personality. As if the inhabitants of this system have abundant means of subsistence. and are distinguished by their proud bearing. Remember, this is like over 2,000 years ago. For this is the Indian system. You know, this is supposed to be according to academia. This is supposed to be a primitive system, but this is much more advanced than anything that's been in the West. For the law ordains that no one among them shall, under any circumstances, be a slave. And you certainly had slavery in Europe. And we certainly had slavery in America. I mean, in ancient Greece, you know, you say it was a democracy, but the only people who could vote were free men. Men, not women, who were considered like slaves. And there were more slaves than free men in ancient Greece. So here's a culture thousands of years before that. Well, not thousands of years before that, but way before that. There was freedom, equal rights to all citizens. Their philosophers were exempt from all duties, and neither the masters nor the servants of others. So that's the Brahmanas. You know, the Brahmanas are exempt from duties, and they don't take service. I mean, they don't give service to others. Among the Indians, I'm just taking some quotes out of context. Among the Indians, officers are appointed whose duty is it to see that no foreigner is mistreated. Should any of the foreigners lose his health, they send physicians to attend him. In other words, if you went there as a tourist, they would take care of you. Pretty good. So Ashok, who was the 273 to 231 BC, just to give you a little time frame there. 273 to 231 BC, you know, before Christ. He turned his empire enforcing regulations based on compassion to humans and animals alike. That's pretty good. Animal rights in India. There was a Chinese guy called Fa Xian who spoke about how peaceful India was, and he said there was a rarity of serious crime and administration was very, very fair. And he said you could travel from one end of the country to another without any fear of being bothered or molestation, as he said. Okay, any questions so far? Because we got about 25 more minutes, yeah.
I've read in Manusamhita their description of some torturing, like the kings were torturing, like if it was a woman making adultery, there was some severe, you know, like Inquisition in Vedic times.
Okay, I'll give an explanation. First of all, there was, the punishments are given in the Manusamhita. Secondly, we're going to be talking about the modern editions of some of the ancient Vedic literatures and how they've been corrupted. I'm not saying it's a corrupt literature, how they've been corrupted by having things taken out, put in, or changed in the same literature. For example, in the Mahabharata, you had Madhvacharya say directly, and Madhvacharya wrote a commentary on the Mahabharata, the Mahabharata has been corrupted. About 80 years ago, a group of scholars got together to try to come up with what they call academically a critical edition of the Mahabharata. Critical means trying to find out what the original is by taking all the editions. There were 80 different editions of the Mahabharata, all different. And 11 different cultural traditions in the Mahabharata. I mean, different parts of India, you know, Bengal, South India, North India. I mean, I'll give you an example. In one edition of the Mahabharata, you know the story of Parashara Muni where he sees Satyavati? Everybody knows that story? Satyavati, let me tell the story. Satyavati is rowing. She's ostensibly a fisherman's daughter. Actually, she was the daughter of a king. But anyway, she was acting as a fisherman's daughter. So she's to make a little extra money. She's rowing a boat across the Ganges. And, you know, carrying passengers. So Parashara Muni sees her. And, you know, when he gets in the boat, he says to her, we should have a child, you know, something like that. You know, relationship. And she makes some objection, you know, we're in the middle of the river, you know, even if we go to that island, you know, all this, everybody's looking, I'm a young maiden who's going to get married to me later on. And then he says, you know, this is meant to be, and then he makes a big fog. You know, they go to an island, he restores her virginity afterwards. That's the story we're accustomed to hearing, right? I think those of you who read Mahabharata know that story. Everybody knows the story? Yeah. Okay. So, and then as a result, Vyasadeva is born. Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasadeva. Okay. So that's one version. But then you have South India where everyone is super conservative. You know, they're not going to accept this, that Parashara Muni had this relationship with this girl in the boat and Vyasadeva was born. So in their edition of the Mahabharata, they have Parashara Muni getting married to Satyavati and raising up little Vyasadeva. So, anyway, so I'm just giving you an idea of the various versions of the Mahabharata that are there. And what to speak of, you know, you may raise the question about the Manusmriti, the Manusamhita. Same thing with that. So, it's important to ascertain what is the original version of it. Of course, we know we have the original version of the Bhagavatam. Many of the other Puranas have been tampered with in different ways. Does everybody understand that? So, it's an important point to understand when dealing with Vedic literature. Okay? So that was a good question. And brought out an interesting point that most devotees don't know about that, the various editions of the Mahabharata. And actually, when you have different details of the Mahabharata that appear to conflict with the Srimad Bhagavatam, we always accept the Srimad Bhagavatam's version. So, I wanted to start talking about the dating of Vedic literature and the European study of Sanskrit. Unless we have any other questions, we can start with that. Yes.
What did they come up with? What was the original version of the Mahabharata? What did those scholars come up with?
They actually said that it's very difficult to ascertain. I mean, that was the conclusion. That was about 80 years ago. They had a meeting of the top scholars. And they said, you know, it's very... They also said that it appears the Mahabharata has been written by different authors, which we know is not true. But that also involves the whole point of oral tradition, which is important. Thank you for bringing that point up, because I had to talk about oral tradition and I forgot to talk about that. So previous to the time of what we understand as written language, at least written language that we have evidence of, which is about the time of Emperor Ashok. You know, Emperor Ashok had all these columns, you know, written, talking about the aphorisms of Buddhism, and they're all over India. So previous to that time, the tradition is that there was expert memorization of things, especially with the Vedic mantras. That the Brahmanas, they had developed methods, because the Vedic mantras had to be chanted precisely with meter, you know, rhythm, meter. Everything has to be precise to be effective. I mean, just like we know stories from the Bhagavatam, where one Brahmana wanted to create an enemy of Indra. Indra Shatruhu. So the mantra was just one syllable was pronounced wrong, and what happened? Does anyone know the story? Yeah, but it's a sort of story. Instead, the person was created, Indra would be the enemy of. Instead of being the enemy of Indra, Indra would be the enemy of him. You understand? Just by a mispronunciation. So there was very precise pronunciation. And so the tradition was carried on like that during the original, you know, the Vedic period. So even the stories we have, yeah, of course the Mahabharata and everything like that, that was actually passed down. Of course, that was spoken or given to us by Vyasadeva long before, you know, the period we're talking about right now. And that was passed down through the oral tradition. And because it wasn't written at that precise time, at least on Earth. I mean, I know there's stories about Ganesh writing down everything. But at least on Earth it wasn't written. Therefore, after the advent of Kali Yuga, you know, Manda Sumanda Matayo Banda Bhagya Padrata, the people's memories weren't so fantastic. So when you're talking about the Mahabharata story, for example, every Mahabharata has the basic storyline. So you can extract and understand the basic storyline, you know, the five Pandavas, Dhritarashtra, Kurukshetra, the basic characters and everything like that, Duryodhana. But the differences are in some of the details there. And that's due to the oral tradition. And that's because of that oral tradition, the scholars are dating, and we're going to talk about the dating of the Vedic literatures, are misdating the Vedic literatures because they date it on the basis of the oral, you know, when the oral statement was written down. So a scholar may say the Vedic literatures are 2,200 years old, but that may be when that particular thing was written down. But actually, the Vedic literatures are, first of all, eternal. And they were compiled by Vyasadeva. Vyas divided. Vyas, the word Vyas means to divide. Originally, the Vedas were one. Vyas, Samas means to put together. Vyas means to divide. So they're more or less commenting on what they think. When they say that it's the age of the Vedic literatures, they're commenting on basically the writing rather than the actual literature itself. So that's the misdating of the Vedic literatures. So getting back to your question is what they concluded was something that really wasn't true. That, I mean, the author of the Mahabharata is actually Srila Vyasadeva, but they were commenting on different interpretations. So they came up with it. They're, you know, basically there were many different authors, and let's put it all together. And there's no original Mahabharata, you know. So, but that's the problem. That's the problem with the study, the Indology. Okay. So do we have time to go ahead with a study of Vedic literature, the Western study of Vedic literature? Yeah. Mainly. I mean, the Kshatriyas, the twice born Kshatriyas, would also study different parts of the Vedic literatures. Oh, you mean when I say high class Brahmanas?
No, I
meant that as a description of Brahmanas. High class. But the Brahmanas specialized in different activities. I mean, the Brahmanas who did sacrifices, Brahmanas did philosophy, and the even the Brahminical tradition became, let's say, too much absorbed in the ritual. The Brahmanas became too much absorbed around 2,500 years ago in general in the rituals of the original Vedic literatures. And actually, there's many points before we go into the next part that I just must mention right now. That in the original, let's say the Rig Veda, the scholars will study the Rig Veda and they will say, in the Rig Veda, most of the hymns are to who? Does anyone know? Any Rig Veda scholars? Indra. Indra, they'll say most of the hymns are to Indra. So Indra must be supreme, right? According to that logic. But remember, those hymns in the Rig Veda to Indra are actually not acknowledging the fact that, or putting forth the opinion that Indra is supreme. They're just practical dealings. I'll give you an example. Let us say you are dealing with the government here in Croatia. Or let's say you're getting a driver's license. Will you deal primarily with the president or prime minister of Croatia? Or are you going to deal with just the minor functionary in the office? Answer, which one? I mean, so all your details and everything will not even be considering the ultimate, the supreme controller of Croatia, whoever it is, you know, prime minister or president. So when you're dealing with these, the demigod worship, some of the Karmakanda stuff, then mainly you're going to be approaching, the functionaries like Indra. You know, later on, you don't find Indra worship so much. And Agni, of course, is very much considered in the original Vedas. So that's just practical. You can't determine who is God just by doing a number count of whose name is used the most. In fact, in the original Vedas, there's in the Rig Veda, it's a statement, and I'm sure you know the statement, Om Tad Vishnu Param Pada Pashanti Yat Suryah, that all the demigods, they're looking to Vishnu. So even though Vishnu is not mentioned so much there, I mean, indirectly, you have the stuff about the, you know, the Purusha Shukta, but still, we understand that there's direct statements about the worship of Vishnu in the Rig Veda. And there's no indication in the Rig Veda that Indra is the supreme personality of Godhead. There's just hymns to him for other purposes. And we'll talk about that a little later. Actually, we only have about 7 more minutes. And so tomorrow I have quite a bit of information about the European study of the Vedic literature, and I can explain a lot about Indology, why they've tried to decry Sanskrit, the Vedic literature, the Vedic system or culture, and India in general. And this is based upon their cultural bias, in fact, racism. Now, one interesting point, and tomorrow we'll talk more about this, one interesting point is that up until the modern day and age, it was considered proper to be a racist, whether you like that or not. I mean, certainly in Greece, it was considered proper to be a racist. We're not talking about India. We're talking about Europe, America, you know, this part of the world. To be a racist, we're born in a certain family, you look down at another family. This was considered perfectly proper. Just like it's considered perfectly proper today to be a nationalist, maybe it is, I don't know. I mean, it's like just like a few years ago, you know, we're Serbians, we're Croatians, we're... Even today, it's like that. I mean, what's different between that and being a racist, right? you know, American, race, Russian, you know, whatever. That's racism. It's a type of racism, or nationalism, actually. So Europe, basically the people in Europe, especially the intellectuals, had this air of cultural superiority. That is, we are, let's see, any other culture in the world that appears to be advanced has actually come from us. And that's where that whole myth of what we call the Aryan invasion came from. They actually said, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow, the reason people are so educated in Europe, and in India, sorry, and intelligent, and come up with all this wonderful Vedic literature, is because originally we went there. Otherwise, it's impossible for these darker-skinned people, you know, this race that's not European, to actually have come up with any philosophy or any intelligent thing. It's us. We went there and we made the mistake of intermarrying with some of these people. That's, you know, that's racism. And so the whole study, Indological study in Europe originally of India, you know, Indological, that means study of India, was actually based upon that racist supposition or presupposition. You know, everyone from Max Muller, all these personalities will be mentioned tomorrow, beginning with Sir William Jones in 1786. Were influenced by this racial superiority complex. Therefore, the only way they could deal with an advanced civilization in India was to come up with the theory that they were Europeans who actually originally went there. And this theory was later disproved by scientific evidence. That's called the Aryan invasion theory, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. So any quick questions or comments? We only have about 5 minutes left. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's different versions. The Ramayana has a little less versions than the Mahabharata. I mean, when you go to the original Valmiki Ramayana, yeah. The Valmiki or the Valmiki Ramayana? Yeah, because yeah, South Indian, North India are a little bit different in their interpretation. Yeah. Yeah, there's slight differences. Usually the Valmiki editions, they're pretty similar. And the Tulsidas Ramayan, Prabhupada said, anyway, I won't mention because it may offend some people. But that's what people usually study in India or know about in India is the Tulsidas Ramayan, not the Valmiki Ramayan. One of the places where I do a lot of preaching is Fiji. And practically speaking, when I talk about the Ramayana with them, because I've read the Valmiki Ramayana several times, and I, you know, most of the stories in it, I tell them stories they've never heard about Lord Ram, because they're accustomed to the Tulsidas Ramayana. Tulsidas, Prabhupada said, was, I guess there's no Indians here, was not a pure devotee. They get upset when I say that. And Tulsidas was sort of a chauvinist. I think you know the quotes from that, yeah? He said, anyway, I'm not going to tell you what he said. But he said certain things about, you know, you can beat your wife or something or your drum. So he's the person from whom or from whose writings most people in India nowadays, because he wrote in the vernacular, the Hindi, know about Ram. But we're interested in the Valmiki Ramayana. Well, it comes from an oral tradition. When you're talking about two versions of the Valmiki Ramayana, it's an oral tradition that was later written down. And somehow or other in oral traditions, has anyone ever played that game, Telephone? I mean, like today, for example, I'll give you an example. Today I told Dadi Baksha, I said, on Wednesday, Wednesday is the Rath Yatra day. So I said, on Wednesday, what should happen? I'll give class on Wednesday and I won't give the seminar on Wednesday. Okay. So he told that to someone else. He told that to someone else. And finally it came out that I wasn't giving the seminar today. So everybody was thinking there's no seminar today. And that's probably just two or three people passing down the line. I said I wasn't going to give on Wednesday because it's Rath Yatra day. I wanted to give someone else my slot. The person who was giving the seminar in the afternoon could move to my slot so they wouldn't be deprived of that day, and I would give Bhagavatam class that day. So that's the game of telephone. I said, you said. So that's the problem. When you don't have people who are Shruti Dharas, Shruti Dhara means, it means you can just remember everything you've heard. We don't have many Shruti Dharas here. Therefore, you need a notebook. And I even need an electronic notebook. I'm even more advanced than you. So, electronic book. Anyway, and I need, we have this. We're recording here. We're recording there. You didn't need that stuff. We think we're advanced. We think, oh, we're such a nice society. We have electronic computers and recorders, MP3s. Oh, yeah, we're so advanced because our brains are so damn dull. That's why we need all these things. That's not advancement. It's like saying someone who can't walk is advanced because he's using crutches. Right? Same thing. Or saying, because I'm advanced, my eyesight is advanced because I'm using glasses. That means my eyes are imperfect. That's why I have to wear glasses. Not because I have better eyes than you, or because glasses are something wonderful coming from the spiritual world. Glasses show my imperfection, not my perfection. So the point is that, you know, we have to do these things because the memories are bad. So when we tell stories, they always come out differently. And that's the problem. Therefore, Sripad Madhvacharya did say, even though he did comment on the Mahabharata, he did say that the text has been changed. Things taken out, things put in, things internally adjusted, changed, etc. 11 different traditions of the Mahabharata, about 80 different versions. Anyway, Srimad Bhagavatam, we have the original Srimad Bhagavatam, we have original Bhagavad Gita, we have the original books of the Goswamis of Vrindavan. So, these we have the original texts of. Any other questions? Yeah.
How do we know they're original?
How do we know they're original? Evam parampara praptam imam rajarshayo vidahu. That's actually good. That involves the whole question of epistemology and how do we know what we know. Because we do have an unbroken chain of disciplic succession that has dealt with the Bhagavatam. And the, you know, there are commentaries on the Bhagavatam. And the commentaries are about specific verses, you know, each and every verse there are commentaries on. And the Gita, the same thing. Whereas, and we can get into that later on if we have time in the course. There are actually more commentaries on the Bhagavad Purana than there are all the other Puranas combined, which is interesting. And we're talking about commentaries in India through spiritual traditions and also outside of India, because the Bhagavad Purana is understood to be in its original form. I mean, there's a few verses you'll read, like Prabhupada will talk about in his purports, that some commentators put this verse in, some commentators don't put this verse in. But other than that, you know, a few verses, a handful of verses. The Acharyas, you know, you're talking about Sripad Madhvacharya and Ramanujacharya, Sridhar Swami, like that. They've ascertained it to be that way. It's coming down unbroken. That's the benefit of a chain of disciplic succession. Whereas we don't have an unbroken chain of like the Mahabharata. In fact, our acharyas say it has been broken. In fact, you know, they've said the opposite. A Madhvacharya says quite the opposite. Yeah.
Sometimes you hear different stories about the Leelas.
Yeah.
And then you hear devotees say it is because happened in other yuga.
That's true too. When you find stories presented in a different way about the same Leela, or different Leelas in the same place, or something like that, that are presented by a bona fide source that's coming down to cyclic succession. I mean, I can think of several like that. I mean, that and so these happen at different times, places, and circumstances. You know, different yugas. I mean, that also involves the Indian or Vedic understanding of historiography, which I wanted to leave for tomorrow, but I can just mention in brief. In the West, we have this Newtonian conception of history, where we got to get the dates right and everything like that. In India, the idea is to present Siddhanta, not just to give the details. Like in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. You ever hear that before? Columbus? Anyone's heard of Columbus? No. Okay. Anyway. Go read your history books. So, but it's not really important. I remember going to school and learning all these dates. Does anyone remember going to school? Having a test and learning all these stupid dates that have nothing to do with anything as far as practical understanding. When Vasco da Gama did this, when Ponce de Leon discovered the Fountain of Youth, and he still died. And useless stuff. No understanding. Whereas the Vedic literature is the whole point. The presentation is in Siddhanta. Understanding something. Understanding the purpose of life. Sambandhavideya Prayojana. You know, who is God? What is the soul? What's happening in the spiritual world? So the acharyas will sometimes conflate two stories. Like that story of Baraha, Lord Baraha. You know, the Bhagavatam specifically, the acharyas say, you know, that the story actually contains two different instances of the appearance of Lord Varaha. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is the Siddhanta, the pastimes. Newtonian history is actually something different than we present, or the Indian Vedic system, because they're interested in understanding. And in the West, we're interested in just like detailed knowledge. Just like Krishna says in the Gita, after he presents the whole chapter in the opulence of the Absolute, what does he say? Does anyone know that? He says, what is the use of all this detailed knowledge? But with a single fragment of myself, I pervade the entire cosmos. So in other words, you can go back to Godhead without knowing that of aquatics, you know, Krishna's a shark. You just have to know. The whole point of the chapter is that, you know, everything comes from Krishna. Aham sarvasya prabhu matak sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajanti mam. Isn't it? That's the whole point. I mean, Krishna's not, when you die, you're not going to be asked, of what fish is Krishna? You have three answers. You know, three answers. Is Krishna a Timangila fish? You know, is he a carp, or is he a salmon? Or is he a shark? And if you get it wrong, back to the material world for you. You know, that's not the point that Krishna makes in the Gita. Okay. I think we have the next seminar coming. Sorry for too long. Okay, all glories to Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.